Venerable sir, my friends, yesterday evening Dr. Bidulph talked to us, and I was rather struck by something that he said right at the beginning of his talk, when he said or told us of a patient who came up to Carl Gustav Jung and said, "Last night I dreamt that I had disinfected the whole of heavens with lysergic acid." And we all smile on that. But I'm wondering whether we really ever have thought that we all have exactly done that, certainly ever since our scientific enlightenment, that we have that dissecting acid, our intellect, which is certainly one of our most important tools, but that we have let it run away into fields which it does not really belong to, and therefore it has etched into things which are dear to us, which are warming us, which are a rock and a refuge to us. In other words, we have put too many things onto the intellect, and we have really denuded our heart. We have forgotten what religion really means. And Zen Buddhism, like Buddhism, like all religions, have another function than the intellectual one. The intellect is important. Without it, we would no doubt still be somewhere in the caves. But as a very famous Zen master said, however important a tool a hammer is, and without that hammer we could not exist, we could not build, we have used it for almost everything, but it is quite useless to try to go fishing with a hammer. And so perhaps in order to go fishing, if we want to do, we need to take a rod, not a hammer. And if we want to have satisfaction not only in the upper story in our head, and there must be satisfaction in that too, or something is missing, but we also must have something that satisfies the heart, that warms the heart, that touches the heart. And with that, very strongly connected, is also something that we have almost forgotten nowadays, and it is this gesture. Strangely enough, it is in this gesture, even if the head, louder, even if the head has forgotten what this gesture means, the body remembers. It is for a moment that I lay down my conscious side, and in that moment something opens up. I think we all know moments of this. Nothing necessarily perhaps to do with religion, but something that is fleeting and poignant and that hits us, like the sun sinking. For a moment we are touched, moved, and in that being touched and moved have forgotten ourselves. And something touches, fills. This is why we remember such moments. Deeply moved, connected with the bow. And therefore in religion we have much to do with folding of the hands and with bowing. Not in the idea that we have to grovel now, because that is only another idea of the intellect. But making a condition where for a moment I go down from this upper story so that the heart can open and be replenished. Because if we go into the actual Latin meaning of religion, at least I think this is the root of it, religio, is to be relinked again from the isolation, from the deluded separation that I think I am as different and separate from you all, to that where our common ground is. And that also is a function of the heart. When I was first accepted as a serious student by my late teacher, who died after I had been 6 years under him, I was taken by the head monk to show exactly how to come for those interviews and to behave. And he made me go through the form, having shown me himself in the body, so that he was satisfied I would do it correctly. And it entails coming into the interview room, which is very small, a full prostration, which goes to the Buddha. And when he was satisfied I could do the whole thing properly now and could tell the sequence, he stopped me at the threshold and said, "You know, all we say in Zen training, all that is needed is to make this prostration really complete." Then he smiled and said, "It's very easy to lay the body down." Well, for a Westerner, not even this is exactly very easy right way. But he said, very easy to lay the body down. But what is necessary to lay down completely the whole of oneself, one's heart too, totally. That is all that is needed in Zen training, said he, and smiled and said, we generally believe that it takes 10 to 15 years to bring it off. So this laying down, this letting go, sounds actually very splendid, but it can unfortunately not be done by an act of will. And this is why we need the religious training disciplines. And another thing, and lots of things have been said about this religious training disciplines, and books and volumes have been written about. And again, I would like to go back to Sesso Roshi, my late master, who once, when I had been for about 3 years under him, I had a special permission, perhaps once a fortnight, to come in the afternoon to him and help him with whatever I could help. Usually, being not very much versed in Japanese things, it was rubbing ink for him, the ink sticks, because he was a very great calligrapher. And whilst I was working away and he would be writing, he usually told me things, very simple stories. One had to be very careful, at least I found, taking them home, milling them over. After about half a day or something, the point would suddenly really click in, and one did not have to be deceived by that seeming simplicity. But one day he received me in quite a different manner. The moment I came in, he looked at me and said, "And of course, the thing that is really important, that cannot be translated." And I thought, well, he meant the translation of special texts, or perhaps the translation of these koan questions which come into the Rinzai training, and thought, well, yes, I can imagine how difficult it is. I know how much work I have to do on even trying to get the meaning of those characters before I'm even working on them. So I said yes, and he gave me one look and said, "You don't understand. What I really mean is that a lot of things can correctly be described, but the really important thing that cannot be translated." And being still fully convinced that this is what he was pointing at, I said again, "Yes." And he said, "You just don't see what I mean." And then he gave me a beautiful example. And though it was in Japanese context, I think I can bring it over and I would like to share that with you. The traditional Japanese religion is Shinto, the way of the gods. And there are beautiful, immaculate shrines built for those, one could almost say nature deities. And there is an innermost shrine where the deity is supposed to live. And in front of it is a larger building, and there hangs a large, that thick rope, straw rope, with a bell on top of it. And the believer comes and puts a small offering in a coffer and then pulls that rope so that the bell on top of it gives a sound, and that summons the deity. And then in that presence, the believer bows. And this is what Sesso Roshi described to me. and smiled then and said, and you see, whether you actually see that presence or not, whether it is actually there or not, even that is not the point, because it cannot be seen in any case. But what happens in the heart of the sincere believer at the moment that he bows in the presence, that is the blessing. And there we come again back into the religious field, that which fills the heart, that which nourishes, and that which succours, which the head alone, the intellect, cannot produce. And the question is how, in our irreligious time, where we have almost lost that, how can we return to it? Can we actually return to it? Or is it not much more a question in the same way that we cannot return to our childhood anymore, but that we must go forward, but for once go forward with a bowed head until we come on that and do that main line again? And perhaps there is much practical thing in the Zen training, and the body is very much taken in. Could we, as a rough analogy, perhaps say that we have I'll be very careful of this, we have started to trust our intellect and have walked with that one leg, and further walked, and further walked, and further walked, and further walked, and this has remained behind. And we certainly find nowadays that we are fully extended, and we can really hardly move at all. And it is therefore perhaps wise that we begin to bring that neglected leg up until we are once again on a par, so that in balance we can go forward. And of the Japanese Zen master Hakuin, there is therefore a lovely story. He also, Japan being an island country as this one, he gave as a short example, if one wants to know what seawater tastes like, it's no good trying to read it in books, and for us it is no good trying to make it into a chemical analysis and all those things. But Master Hakuin suggests that if one really wants to know what that seawater tastes like, one only needs to go out by one's front door and to walk on in a straight direction. Sooner or later, it being an island, one is bound to come to the shore. And if coming and arriving at the shore, one again bows down, because one has to, the water is down, and puts one's finger in and licks that drop off, at that moment one knows the taste of all the seven oceans. And I think that is perhaps a very useful analogy for where Zen points us. But what is Zen? Zen Buddhism, this Zen school of Buddhism. The light of Zen, this talk is called. But it is actually a misnomer. It is the light that the person, that man who himself awakened, who himself rediscovered that ancient past, it is the light of that awakening of the Buddha himself, which shines through the millennia. And this is also the light that we have in Zen. There is much that we have heard over the last 1.5 days, anyway, since we came here, on Buddhism. And perhaps some of you may have thought, oh, after all, it's always the same. Everybody talks about the same things. Isn't there anything new in that Buddhism at all? I have found myself that one is generally told very little when one gets under training. And one says, oh yes, of course, naturally. And before one knows where one has tried and has found that it is not quite so much a matter of course and natural. And before one has gone even a few days, one has cleanly forgotten it again. And then one needs a reminder, same old thing. And one says, oh yes, of course, naturally. And within a few days again, one has first failed to do it, and because it is a little bit awkward to admit that one has failed to do it and slipped up, one forgets it again. And so it is not a question of having something new added and something new gained and some new attainment at every step, but it is really a question of those very simple things really sinking in, really digested, in the same way as, I don't know, the egg that I might have eaten yesterday at breakfast. I cannot say now, here it sticks now, or it's in my knee, but it has really become, it has nourished and become the whole body. That, I think, is important. And there is also a very beautiful story on this same simple old thing, which comes from the Chinese Zen times of the Tang Dynasty, where a very famous, profound Confucian scholar lived at the capital and heard a rumor that somewhere deep down in the barbarian south, and there had arisen a new school with an even more profound doctrine. And he was a little bit perturbed by it, and he wanted to find out, but since there was nobody deeper versed than he was, and in spite of his 80 years, he undertook the long, hazardous, dangerous, uncomfortable journey down to that barbarian south, and it took him some months, and he found that place and introduced, it was one of those newly arisen Zen schools, and he introduced himself there, said who he was and what he had come for, and suggested that the only way in which they could settle that point was that they would each tell each other their doctrines and then decide as two gentlemen, that the one or the others was the more profound ones. And so the confusion started with this. And it took him a few hours to really honestly lay down all his understanding and the depths and the profundity of his understanding. When he had finished, he asked the Zen master, now would you please? And the Zen master said, to avoid doing harm as much as possible, to do as much as possible good. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. Actually, this verse comes from a Buddhist scripture called the Dhammapada, and in it there are four lines for this. If I may take this aside, because I think it is important. To avoid doing as much as possible, to avoid doing harm as much as possible, to do good as much as possible, to purify the heart. That is the teaching of the Buddha. And in this version of the Zen master, to purify the heart is left out. Because if it is really possible, and that is the point, if it is really possible for us weak human beings to avoid doing harm to ourselves and others, and only to do good anymore, that precisely is the purification. That means that the heart is purified already. And that is the teaching of the Buddhas. Anyway, this is what the Zen master gave as an answer to the Confucian master. And upon this, the Confucian master really was angry. And I think we all can understand that he was angry, because I do also feel that he had every right to be angry. He was over 80. In all decency, he had taken that 3 months thoroughly uncomfortable, dangerous journey. He had introduced himself in all openness. He had held nothing back. He had behaved in a perfect way. And he had asked the cooperation and had had the agreement. And instead of this, as he said, you answer me with a little jingle that every 3-year-old child knows by heart. Are you mocking me? And the Zen master said, no, please do not misunderstand. I have no intention of mocking. It is true that every 3-year-old child knows that verse by heart. But if a man of 80, as you see, fails to live up to it. And that is really the question. Ever since we became human, not only individually, but generally, we have always known that to do good and not to harm ourselves or others is the right thing, the decent thing, is what we actually really want, how we really wish to behave. In our deepest hearts, this is what we know is the thing. But if we look at our history, we can say neither collectively or personally, always, ever, do we manage to bring it off. And therefore it is not a question, and this is what it seems the Buddha rediscovered, it is not a question of having something new that we should do, something new that we should learn, but simply to find out what that obstacle inside us is that prevents us from doing what in our deepest heart we after all really do want to do, what carries us again and again away out of ourselves, runs us not into crude deeds, but also into our deep opinions, in our considerations, where we are deeply convinced and get hot and bothered if somebody does not agree with us. We heard on Friday, the first evening, about the Buddha and his life. Very, very beautiful. The whole training, the whole progression of the training is reflected in that life. You remember the temptation of Mara when he was already sitting on that immovable spot, stripped of everything with which he was born and which he had acquired, left even by those five disciples in the end. He had nothing left. And at that, and only at that stage, at that time, is it possible to sit down on that immovable spot as he did. And then he was assailed by Mara. And if I just for a moment may recap this, please. Assailed by Mara on those three things that are strongest in us. First of all, assailed by Mara by saying, the noble life is lived, thou canst now depart, go home, and take up your duties as a prince. And the Buddha did not listen to him. And then Mara changed his tactics, and he sent his voluptuous daughters to assail the would-be Buddha. I don't know, because I'm not a man. I don't know what would happen if Mara would send his sons, I being a woman. But there is one thing which I do know, and that is if Mara really bestirs himself and sends the best of his creatures, either a man or a woman, I wonder whether one could really withstand them. And we can therefore take it that the being that sat there was so completely sitting that that eye that can be hooked on was not there anymore. And it is because of this that the daughters could not get hold of him, because he was not there. And Mara, seeing this, changed then into his last tactics, fear. And we have duty, desire, fear, and we'll meet them again and again. And he sent his demons. And the demons would get hold. Mara's demon certainly would get hold of whatever is there. But if nothing is there, what can demons get hold of? Even demons cannot get hold of nothing. And it is on that it is beautifully in the legends taken how in the first night what she attained and so on. But what interests us is when he awakened from that delusion of I-hood to that insight, to that light of anatta, of no I. What were the first words that he said? And if I quote them incorrectly, I hope the Venerable Sir will correct me, please. Now I have seen you, builder of the house. The rich pole is broken. Never will you build new houses again. Who is that builder of the house? And what is the rich pole? And what is the house? And I'm talking now to you and over something that interests me extremely well. I'm drinking this without even being aware of it, and then I'm fiddling a little bit with this. So we spend actually our life always in a roundabout thing, never on what we are doing. Our mind is full of continuously weaving pictures. Isn't it, if we are honest? And those pictures carry us away, further and further away from the home base. Those pictures weave a web of delusion that I see the world as I believe it is, and it has the audacity to be after all as it really is, and so I come in conflict with it. That is those pictures that we weave. That is the houses, and the builder of the house is what I like as it suits me, as I think it ought to be, as I also think you ought to be, rather than I, as I also think I ought to be and believe I am, but my friends tell me something quite different. And so this is that weaving of pictures which are making our troubles, because those pictures are only fabrications of I. I find occasionally roughly coming to the fact that they do not exactly coincide with what I think, then there is sorrow and lamentation. And so this builder of the house, this weaver of pictures, this is I. The delusion of which the Buddha talked and which he saw as the picture maker, this I, and of which he said, now I have seen you, builder of the house. The rich pole is broken. Never will you build new houses again. And if you really think of it, the enormous, vast literature that Buddhism has. But it all reduces down to a very few things. And only the Buddha himself could sum it up in one single sentence. Suffering I teach, and the way out of suffering. That suffering from the delusion of I, and the way out of that delusion. Back to where we always have been. And then can I come on a concrete analogy, which I think will help us perhaps, and which I like very much because, unlike most analogies, it goes almost all the way. If I want to learn to swim, reading books about it, studying is really not of much use. It's something that I have to face. To strip, to go actually into the water and try. I have met a few people who have learned it in a very rough way by being thrown into the deep water. And they have, a few of them, have actually learned to swim that way. But I have seen them swimming because I made the experiment. They have not really been swimming. They've been fighting the water all the time. Normally, we go in the shallow end. and try, and try, and try. And it entails quite a few mouthfuls of either bitter seawater or chlorinated pool water, which is perhaps even more unpleasant. But if we only go on with this trying, which seems in a way a silly exercise to do, and nothing to do with swimming, which after all I want to learn. But perhaps in the moments when I'm not just trying, I might think that every mammal, if it falls actually into water and the water is smooth, even cats that chronically dislike water, if they fall in, they swim out naturally. And after all, we are mammals too. Why can't we swim naturally? Why must we learn to do what we naturally actually are perfectly capable of doing? So with that, we go back into the shallow end again and go on trying. And sooner or later will come a moment where we have got a good amount of familiarity with the water and might also be quite a little bit tired. And at that moment we forget fighting the water and trying. And at that moment where we forget and relax, we feel the water buoys us up. But the moment this awareness hits me, down goes the foot to the safe bottom again. And so all that we need to do and must do instead of being elated by this moment of floating is to go on with that same dreary old exercise of trying and trying and trying until we become more and more familiar, until we have learned to trust the water, until we have learned to really open up and give ourselves completely to it. And the water will carry us, if it is reasonably quiet. That has not yet made me a swimmer, but it has made me a comfortable floater. And the real swimming styles, unless I want to go into Olympic team, then I have to have a lot on style training. But the real swimming styles, like a breaststroke or a crawl stroke or so on, or a backstroke, they're not really so difficult to learn anymore. As I say, unless I want to go into the Olympics, then there is a lot more training to be done. But by and large, that is it. And if Philip would have said to me, being able to swim, and I had confided to him that I wanted to go swimming and learn swimming. And if Philip had said to me, "Look here, old girl, don't be silly. There's absolutely nothing to learn about learning swimming. You just jump in the deep end and you completely relax and the water will carry you," he would have been perfectly right. And this is also what the books tell us. But what the books take for granted that we know, but we do not know, is that I cannot relax by an act of will. That is something which is not possible. Because if I jump in the deep end, what actually happens is that I'm frightened of drowning. That is what prevents us floating. And that fear is something that I cannot overcome by an act of will. That can only be slowly undermined by a training that seemingly has very little to do with it, the training in the shallow thing. But that little by little undermines that fear. And with that, it carries. And I think that is a very important thing to realize when we go into a religious training too. That fear is the other side of I. And we come back again to the Buddha's great teaching on which the core of Buddhism, of anatta. As long as there is a feeling of I, there must be a feeling of other. And that other can and often does interfere with my security, what suits me and all that. And so I have learned to feel that other as a threat. And there is another other, which is a totally other, which I'm even more frightened when it touches me. And that is a very real barrier, as long as there is I. Even for a moment going away from Buddhism and going back into our own culture and religion. I would like to make one point which we have nowadays, since our scientific enlightenment, forgotten, and that is that if we read the Bible, it is not only when the Creator himself, the God that burns in the thorn bush, but it is whenever a heavenly messenger approaches a human being, a mortal, it is invariably with the words, "Fear not." That awe we have forgotten because we have dissected, disinfected heaven with lysergic acid. But if we go into a religious training, it will bring us back to that. Not in order to frighten us, but that awe is something which automatically dwarfs me. And in this dwarfing, in this present, this act is again possible. And with this, the first step of I relaxing in the water, of getting out of the way, my fear is also gone away. And momentary feelings of this we all have at this moment. This is what is meant to go to refuge, to go for refuge to the Buddha, to his teachings, and to the community of those that live it. If you think of the Zen stories, they are highlights, usually the translated ones. And if we take the highlights only, then we really deceive ourselves. There's much talk about awareness also in Buddhism. And we feel that we must be aware. It is I observing carefully, also observing myself, and with this we run ourselves again into trouble, because that only makes that I still stronger and thinks it can control anything. But I would like to suggest an experiment, please. I can observe perfectly the lines in my hand, if it is light enough for it. Can give a running description of it, but if that hand hits me right here, then I lift the impact. And on this awareness, which is a different one, could I ask you for a little experiment, please? Please, not too hard, but pinch yourself into the soft part of your upper arm. Do you need to make a conscious act of awareness of what is happening, or does awareness at that pinch not of itself rise and make itself known? Does it need an eye to be aware of this? This is the awareness we talk on Buddhism, as direct, as immediate, and in the body, not here only, three times removed. And it is in this awareness, and with the idea of this awareness, that I would like to quote to you a saying from the Northern Canon of Buddhism, but I think all schools are perfectly agreed on that, that the passions is the Buddha nature, and the Buddha nature is the passions. That sounds very strange, doesn't it? And if it is taken on that level, it goes into the, you know, Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance, all goes. And with this, we have immediately shown that we know nothing of a religious approach at all. What it really means is that it is the same energy. As long as the builder of the house is there, as long as I am there, I warp it to pictures, and it comes out as I want it and must have, as I will not bear, as my considered opinion, which is so right that you are all completely wrong. Because we must be very careful on those things. But it is that same energy which also, as the quiet sea, carries a good swimmer in the absence of I, And so wherever we take up that web of Buddhism, we come always on that fundamental principle of I. And then I feel, and we all know it, when those things come up in us, we must not be carried away. And so we can either refuse it and stash it down, and it doesn't much help, or we try to control it, try to manipulate, which is another building of the house, almost as if we are sitting behind the panel with various knobs of how I want to be and what I want to have a little bit lower down and a bit higher up and how the world should go. And with that panel in front of us, we actually see nothing of the world around us. And so this controlling is also not of much help. But if that eye is not there, as long as there are body, things are natural. And there's a beautiful Zen saying that I would like to quote in that, which comes, I think, rather together what the Venerable Sir said this morning at meditation. Things arise to laugh, but not to be carried away by laughter. To cry, but not to be carried away by tears. Not to become a zombie, because that is not the human way, and certainly not the Buddha's way, but not to be carried away by an excess of it either. That is the Buddha's middle way, and it is possible in the absence of I. Zen calls itself also the great matter, the matter of life and death, and there is no religion worth the name that does not also confront what we all are confronting sooner or later, that is death. There's a most beautiful Buddhist analogy for that. The ocean. The waves going high. The winds of passion have made those waves rise and tower and rage. But even as such, one wave being trampled on by the wave behind, itself willy-nilly trampling on the wave in front, interfered either way from this side and that by other waves, also raging along, as it is just at the moment of toppling over. If such a wave would feel I, wouldn't it be terrified? But if such a wave could be aware that up or down or any other way, it is in any case nothing but ocean, would all that turmoil, all that fear, all that panic, all that resentment still exist, do you think? This is the shift from I to what in Zen Buddhism is called Buddha nature, from the individual wave to the ocean nature. And this takes away that panicky fear that I have when I come to an end, because there is no need for it. And that, if we really have lived through that shift, makes us realize that even if we have not completely yet outgrown the roots of I, which are in the body, but that death is not an end to be feared, but a fulfillment and a consummation, when the wave has finally really returned to where it always has been. And on that I would like to quote another Zen master, who at that moment of death says, when that moment comes, there is nothing further you can do or need to. You fold your hands and go with it to where you always have been. Please remember this in connection with that great Buddhist teaching of no I, which with us, heady as we are, so easily comes into an abstract discussion of whether there is or is not such a thing as I, which is ludicrous, because as long as I feel I, of course there is. That is precisely the delusion I suffer from. But once that delusion has been lived through, and do not think it is an easy way, but it is possible. and that it is possible, that is what the Buddha had shown us for the first time. Those strange records and stories are not conundrums, are not silly questions to jolt the mind to something else, because the mind, after all, is only I, and wherever I hop is a grasshopper. I will not be hopping out of myself. But those strange stories, I think, are pointers to point us in the direction, to reassure us again and again that it is possible, and that even if something at the moment hurts me very, very badly, that it is useful to say, yes, I am badly hurt, and willing to lift that hurt, because the other great Buddhist teaching is that nothing lasts. And the more I refuse something, the more I actually give it power over me. And the more I say yes to something, even if it hurts, and live it fully through, then it can cleanly go away. This is what the willing yes in Buddhism says, what the bow also shows. And so in that bow, we help ourselves in three different things. Somehow, though I may not be aware of it, the body realizes that I'm not quite so strongly there. And if I do that bow, if I'm in a real trouble, I'll suddenly find the trouble sits not quite so hefty on me. This is also what it means to go to the Buddha for refuge, and to his teaching, and to his community. This ocean nature to which the shift of I makes us fall to. Many names have been given to it. Please be wary of those names, and do not take them as a carrot. And I feel that it is very useful not to bandy them about too much, because as long as there is an I, and we have the story of the Bible too, that really I-less state is something that fills me with awe. And if we were sprung in too quickly, it can shatter that eye. It is the swimming analogy of the slow training that undermines that eye. If we are thrown into the water, even if we can stay on top, we will never be able to relax into it. We will fight it and fight it and fight it. The eye cannot really, truly fall off. And so the training ways, as I see them, are all very long. They're all quite unpleasant and long stretches. The growing pains are natural. But if the process goes correctly, then in the end, that eye is not prized off to lift a wound. It is not bounced off so that it shatters and the whole structure is, but it falls off like a ripe fruit in autumn that does not need to be plucked, but that drops of its own ripeness, and the shift takes naturally place. And in that shift, and that is another thing which is, I think, very important, which is a total re-becoming again. In that shift are released those things that I would always like to have and try to strive for, but can never really possess myself of. Life, warmth, true creativity, and real goodness. I must try to be good, but a real being good, the creativity that is in each individual form, all this is released of itself. I do not need to strive for it. It emerges of itself when that shift takes place. These are the natural gifts of not I. And they have always been referred to in all traditions as grace. And under that grace, the bow becomes very natural. It's a natural expression in gratitude to the Buddha, who rediscovered that way of how this shift takes place. In gratitude to his teachings, which is still with us and which we can follow. And in gratitude to all those, that long, long line since the Buddha, who have gone that way and who have given their lives in going that way, so that it is still open for us and that we still can find it and that we still can walk it if we are so minded. And in gratitude that this way releases us from that narrowhood, from the tremors, from the fear of I, and opens to us a partaking, a real partaking in life as it is. There's an old Zen master who said, "How wonderful, how miraculous, I carry wood and I fetch water." If we can see life surrounding us as it is, that wonder and that miracle in it, we do not need to labor that little eye here into the most fanciful house building, but we can just open up and gratefully participate in what is right here, and not only in carrying wood and fetching water, but in smiling at each other instead of feeling separate from each other. Well, that is taking part in that miracle that life is, in which we all have our being and in which we all are connected together. That seems to be the light of the Buddha, which is also the light of Zen that calls itself the Buddha Heart School.